I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. We're coming up on the 7th anniversary of Superstorm Sandy that devastated coastal communities in New Jersey, causing billions of dollars in damage. Powerful winds and sea level rise are now the norm because of the effects of climate change. Our guest Gilbert Gaul writes in his new book, The Geography of Risk, that hurricanes and coastal storms have become more costly than wildfires, earthquakes, and tornadoes combined, in part because millions of Americans have moved to coastal areas in recent decades. His book focuses largely on Long Beach Island in New Jersey, a barrier island and popular vacation spot with properties worth $15 billion. He says policies that encourage this construction have put homes and businesses in harm's way, and that taxpayers are footing most of the cost for storm recovery. Gilbert Gaul is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Our guest Andrew Lewis's book, The Drowning of Money Island, looks at the impact of climate change and government policies on a poorer, more rural part of South Jersey, the Bayshore in Cumberland County on Delaware Bay. This community was also devastated by Sandy, although rather than get rebuilt, properties were bought and torn down as part of the EPA Blue Acres program of retreat. And Andrew Lewis is a contributing writer to Outside Magazine and also to the New York Times Magazine. Andrew Lewis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And today on Radio Times, two stories about two Americas threatened by coastal storms. Let me begin with New Jersey. In fact, we're going to focus really on New Jersey. I think that makes most sense for our listeners. And Gilbert, I'll begin with you. Why is New Jersey experiencing some of the greatest impact of sea level rise? Why New Jersey?
Well, the Northeast generally is experiencing more sea level rise than other parts of the country, excepting maybe Southeast Florida and certain parts of the Gulf states. But really, it's a combination of things. It's not just that water is rising or storms are becoming more powerful. It's that we have littered our coastlines, and particularly New Jersey, with hundreds of thousands of houses, properties that we've built in what is known as the coastal floodplain, the area that is most vulnerable to sea level rise and to storms. So the combination of these two factors creates a calculus for disasters like Sandy. A lot of people were saying after Sandy, we're so surprised it was such an unusual storm. Now, there were certain aspects of the storm that were interesting meteorologically. Right. It took a hard left-hand turn into the coast, and we haven't seen a hurricane do that for probably a century or somewhere in that neighborhood. But really, for me at least, I've watched the coast all my life.
I was going to say, since you were a lifeguard there.
Right? Well, but even before that, I spent the summer on Long Beach Island when I was 11 years old in 1962 after the Ash Wednesday storm, which is the other bookend storm in the story of the New Jersey coast. So I've lived this and I've seen it.
Well, let me turn to you, Andrew, only because – and we wanted to have the two of you together because I do think it's two different stories about New Jersey and also about storms. You focus on a part of New Jersey that sits on the bay. Help us understand this region of South Jersey.
Yeah, it's a very different place from the Jersey Shore. It's in Cumberland County. The capital B, Bayshore, is in Cumberland County. The entire Delaware Bay coast of South Jersey is about 70 miles. It runs from Cape May County through Cumberland into Salem. And it's an incredibly rural place. It's always been agrarian. It's always been deeply entwined with fishing, particularly the oyster industry. And even today, there's hundreds of farms that blanket the community. The major highways of the Northeast Corridor sort of skip out on Cumberland County. And so this sort of lack of being touched by the Northeast Corridor, the Northeast megalopolis, has really allowed Cumberland County to remain a deeply rural place.
And how did Superstorm Sandy, as we call it, how did Sandy affect this part of South Jersey?
Yeah, it affected it just as much as the Jersey Shore. It's just not that populated, so you didn't hear about it. But on that 40-mile coastline of Cumberland County Bayshore, there's about 3.5 miles of hamlets. And they front the water. They're built just right up into the water, just like homes on the Jersey Shore are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right after Sandy, I came back and I visited Staten Island. I visited the Jersey Shore. I visited Rockaway Beach. And I was astounded by the level of destruction. And just by happenstance, because I'm from Cumberland County, I'm from the Bay Shore, I was home. I finished reporting. I'm going to go home and visit family, right, visit my parents. And they said, when I got home, they said, well, you need to go look at the Bay Shore because it's just as bad as what's happening on the Jersey Shore. And sure enough, I took a drive out there, borrowed my mom's car, and I just spent the day going between these little hamlets and spending time with people. And they were trying to clean up, and yeah. The decks were destroyed. And houses
something
were,
they've been used to doing. But Sandy was even more ferocious, I think, than other storms, or certainly more destructive. Gilbert, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to add that one of the interesting things about Sandy is that the preponderance of the damage that it did was not on the immediate ocean front. There certainly was damage there. We're not minimizing that. But upward of 75% of the damage in New Jersey was along the back bays, including Delaware Bay, where it isn't really heavily developed. But the rest of the back bays in New Jersey, certainly from Atlantic City all the way up to Sandy Hook across from New York City, we have built an estimated 300,000 houses since the 1950s there. So what happened in Sandy was the water built up, and then the wind switched on a dime to the south, southwest. Suddenly, all that water came pouring over the wetlands and the salt marsh into homes that had never seen water before.
You talk about the building along the Atlantic City as disaster capitalism, that we have had policies, government policies over the years that have encouraged people to build where there are going to be hurricanes and floods.
Yeah, and this really dovetailed with the development of what I call in my book the modern coast. So after World War II, when the economy was booming and there was a lot of money available, and Americans had endured great suffering and were looking to indulge themselves, that dovetailed with the development of this market for second homes at the beach.
Well, and what's interesting on some of these Bayshore communities that you look at, Andrew Lewis, is that this is, as you say, kind of where poor people would go to vacation, or certainly where, as you say, farmers and fisher people have lived. So this is a much more sort of modest part of New Jersey.
It is modest, but it actually, as Gilbert was just saying, those communities on the Delaware Bay were built for exactly the same reasons that the communities on the Jersey Shore were built. It was post-war. There was an influx of money, chiefly through the WPA. And so, you know, people were a little more flush with money. Those were good times in Cumberland County. And so maybe they didn't want to drive all the way to the Jersey Shore because they had this sort of discreet little coastline right nearby. So they built – there were second homes that were built in these communities as well.
In fact, early on in Long Beach Island, I guess after the war, Gilbert, that's where a lot of teachers and artists and other people went for their getaway.
Right. So one of the ironies of Long Beach Island is that it was really developed as a blue-collar community for teachers, plumbers, electricians, middle-class people. And the cottages that were built starting really in the 40s and then through the 50s were selling for a couple $1,000s. They were 600 square feet. Very, very modest, and in fact, those are the people who bought there, and it was famous for that. And also along the back bays behind Long Beach Island, it was the same developers, so it was a middle class community. And so today,
so what happened? I mean, what turned a property worth, you know, say $10,000 into one that is worth $10 million?
Yeah, so there's only so much land at the coast. And as the islands, the Barrier Islands, got built out, supply and demand came into being. And the price of land at the coast in New Jersey increased astoundingly. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. It started in the 60s, and then it there were several what I call land bubbles where it just blew up sixfold between 1985 and around 2010.
So supply and demand, essentially. You've got limited space and a lot of demand.
Yeah, incredible demand.
Let me go back to you, Andrew, and we're just toggling back and forth between these two stories about New Jersey. But this the rural part that you write about is people making a living, but obviously not getting wealthy.
No, as I mentioned, it hasn't really changed. So, I mean, the oyster industry is still a main employer, if you could say that. There aren't that many jobs, but in general, it's been quite stagnant in Cumberland County. I mean, I think in my research, I remember reading a study by Monmouth University that basically concluded that Cumberland County was the Rodney Dangerfield of New Jersey because it's sort of been
gets
no respect. Yeah, it's been left out of a lot of state funding and that kind of thing. So it never, as beach culture sort of boomed in America, focus switched to the Jersey Shore. And that allowed for investment and for improvements in the coastline, which allowed, more homes to be built, larger homes to be built, and Cumberland County was sort of left in the shadow of that evolution.
But as you say in your book, people living in these communities or the particular community that you look at, they've been used to digging out from other storms. But it seems like Sandy was a whole different category.
Yeah. Sandy was the culmination of a lot of things, and I think one of the main things is, in the 1970s, really, that's when, earlier on from that, but the state really began investing in the Jersey Shore, and they didn't invest in the Bay Shore in the same ways. So that led to, homeowners on the Bay Shore maybe not getting up into compliance with their homes, with codes and all of that sort of thing. So, and the water was rising as well. So beaches were disappearing. A lot of people didn't have money to afford insurance. So when Sandy came, there was a confluence of a lot of things. The infrastructure was weak, and that storm surge that came was about on the Bay Shore. It was around 7 feet of storm surge on top of an already high tide. So the force of that water coming in just crushed these little homes, and there was no beach to stop the waves that night.
I know you want to say something good, but we're up on a break here. I'll give you a chance to do it after this short break. We are, again, toggling back and forth between two books, largely about New Jersey. Andrew Lewis is the author of The Drowning of Money Island, A Forgotten Community's Fight Against the Rising Seas Threatening Coastal America. Gilbert Gall is the author of The Geography of Risk, Epic Storms, Rising Seas, and the Cost of America's Coasts. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Gilbert Gall and Andrew Lewis about New Jersey, about Superstorm Sandy, as we call it, the rising seas, the cost of building or perhaps even retreating from some of this low-lying land. Gilbert, you wanted to add something. We were talking about these more sort of modest bay communities.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. As Andrew pointed out, in Cumberland County, the far less redevelopment after Sandy. The exact opposite happens on the Barrier Islands in New Jersey after Sandy, from one end of the coast to the other end of the coast. It acts as a form, a storm like Sandy acts as a form of kind of urban renewal at the beach, so that the old properties that were perhaps at elevation or only slightly above elevation get wiped out. The owners probably have owned that home for 40 or 50 years. Maybe they're elderly. They don't want to rebuild, so they decide to cash in and sell the house or just leave because they can't afford. Maybe they don't have flood insurance or they don't have a lot of money. The houses, because the land is so valuable, in some cases 10 times more valuable than the property sitting on the sand, what happens is it changes the economics. So it almost forces you to build a large house. And what we've seen after Sandy is that the average square feet of a house has gone on Long Beach Island has gone up to 3,000 square feet, which is 500 square feet larger than the typical American house in the suburbs.
We're talking about really large properties.
It looks like the suburbs at the beach in New Jersey anymore. It doesn't look like an older, authentic beach town. And I'm not being sentimental about it. I'm just explaining this is what the economics did, and that has all kinds of consequences.
Let me just toss something quickly at you, and then, Andrew, I'll go to you. You write that back in the 1950s, the federal government paid for basically 5% of recovery from some of these coastal storms. Well, today, it's closer to 70%, and in some cases, closer to 100%.
Yep. So again, that dovetails with the development at the coast. So we go from modest beach towns to the suburbs at the coast, and the expectations change with that. The folks who now own these homes, many of which are really just investment properties for them, they rarely use them, and they really don't rent them out, surprisingly, either, which is interesting. They don't.
So
run
they
them.
Just sit there vacant?
Yes. And you can go on Long Beach Island during the middle of the summer and see scores and scores and scores of giant houses that are empty during the week. Mom and Dad are back working on Wall Street. The kids are off at camp or polishing their resumes, whatever.
Whatever. And I should say, full disclosure here, I go to Long Beach Island in the summer with my family. But let me turn back to you, Andrew, and let's talk a little bit about this program. It's an EPA program called Blue Acres Program. And this was essentially how New Jersey dealt with Superstorm Sandy in these more bay communities that you looked at.
Right. It was a DEP program, so the New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. And the Blue Acres program has been around since 1995 in New Jersey, but after Sandy, it was infused with $300 million in funding to identify communities where clusters of neighbors might be willing to buy out. Now, you know, there's various ways that communities were targeted. Cumberland has been a county that's been a focus of the state in terms of open space for a long time, so Bay Point and Money Island in particular, these hamlets on the bay, they were sort of already in the purview of the DEP. And they found homeowners there that were willing to sell out. So, you know, it immediately became, I think, obvious to the DEP that they wanted to focus on these communities for these mass buyouts.
And how much, as you said, there were $300 million, how much would an individual homeowner get for their home?
Well, they were, you know, they got pre-Sandy values, which makes the Blue Acres program quite forward-thinking and a solid in program as far as managed retreat is concerned, in my opinion.
And not everyone took it, but some people did. Where do people go? I mean, if this is where you have lived for most of or maybe perhaps even all of your adult life, storm comes in, you lose your house, you get some money, where do you go?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the core problems and the sort of the flaws that we need to look at. As Gilbert said, on the Jersey Shore, there's a lot of second homes. So if a storm like Sandy comes, destroys your home, you have another place to go, probably inland, maybe in the city, where you can sort of sit back and deal with the paperwork and wait it out until your new home gets built. But if all you know, if the only home you've ever lived in has been that one that got destroyed by Sandy, right, you know, a lot of people end up living with children. In the case of a couple characters in the book, they just bought a trailer and had to live in that for years while waiting for essentially the municipality and the state to decide on what they wanted to do with the Blue Acres buyout. So,
oh, really?
So you have a lot of people just sort of hanging in the balance.
Gilbert, it looks like you wanted to add something.
Well, the problem with buyouts at the coast, if we're talking about the immediate coast along the along the oceanfront, is that it really doesn't work, or it hasn't worked. If you look at the $300 million that we had for buyouts in Blue Acres and Sandy, the only place at the coast that I can identify where we actually bought homes was down in Cumberland County along the Delaware Bay.
Right.
There are two versions of the story, but the end result is that I don't think the state was able to purchase a single house along the Barrier Islands in New Jersey. And the reason's pretty simple. The folks don't want to sell, and the value of the
property,
it's too expensive. And so even if you had $300 million, I mean, you might be able to buy 300 houses. And what difference is that going to make?
Yeah. You want to add to that?
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say that I think I was just looking at the recent data from this summer the other day. And there was one property, I think, in Monmouth County, in Seawright, perhaps. But it wasn't an individual property. It was maybe an old condo complex. I'm not quite sure. But but that is actually literally the only property on the oceanfront that was included in the Blue Acres.
And it's pretty much been that way forever with Blue Acres. I mean, they've just been unable to buy it. So most of the Sandy money went to buy property up along in Sayreville, up along the Upper Raritan, and in Passaic in Middlesex counties.
But if we're talking about a program like Blue Acres, is this, Gilbert, is this what we call planned retreat? The idea that some communities are just not going to survive sea level rise, and we have to figure out some semi-organized way of getting people to literally higher ground.
Oren Pilkey, one of the godfathers of coastal geology, was talking about coastal retreat half a century ago, and people laughed at them. They left them off, and nobody paid attention, and we filled up all the islands and beaches with expensive property. So now it becomes extraordinarily difficult to get people to buy into strategic retreat. I'm less optimistic than some people are. I think it can work in communities like Louisiana or along Cumberland County, where we're talking about much more modest places. And it actually would make sense to do that. But I don't think until the seas rise another few feet, or we have another couple Sandys, all of which are very possible, by the way, there's just not enough incentive for people to move at this point in time.
That is Gilbert Gaul. We're talking about New Jersey and his book called The Geography of Risk. He looks at coastal communities across the country. It's subtitled Epic Storms, Rising Seas, and the Cost of America's Coasts. Also with us is Andrew Lewis, and he's got a new book called The Drowning of Money Island, and it's about communities on the bay side of New Jersey. His book is subtitled A Forgotten Communities Fight Against the Rising Seas, Threatening Coastal America. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rob commented on our Facebook page, coastal land wasn't meant for us to live on. Visit maybe, but not live. But let me turn to you, Andrew, because in many ways, the communities that you looked at, these are not vacation communities. This is where people do live and have lived. And the thought of some of these communities being essentially torn apart by storms and maybe even torn apart by policies.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Bayshore is a place where people live. And in fact, it's a place where I lived. It was where I was from. You know, my family goes back generations on the Bayshore. We have oystermen that go back in our family. So it's a little bit different when it's not a second home. It's a home is not just a place to go visit. It's memories. And when a place like that completely disappears, it's essentially relegated to memory. You no longer have you can't drive a street to maybe recall where a house once was or a luncheonette once was. It's gone.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, it's gone because it got torn down, but it's also gone because of sea level rise. I mean, is this, in a sense, this is our future?
This is our future, and managed retreat is our future if seas are going to continue to rise. I mean, maybe on the low end, there's some mitigation efforts, and again, those mitigation efforts will be focused on places where cost benefit analysis makes sense, the Jersey Shore, lower Manhattan. So, you know, no one's immune if the seas are going to rise on the upper end. But nevertheless, managed retreat is going to be occurring at some level. And as the seas continue to rise higher, managed retreat is going to touch more and more people at higher economic strata.
Let me ask you about, we're talking about the New Jersey shoreline, which is, these are beach communities, as you were saying, Gilbert. These are where you can see a lot of very wealthy, expensive homes. At the same time, this is where New Jersey makes a lot of its money because it's a, you know, a tourist mecca. You just made a face at me on that. But is that an argument for investing in these communities because that's where New Jersey makes a lot of its money?
Well, that's the argument that's going to be made. And it's already being made, and it's already the justification for doing things like spending federal tax dollars to widen beaches in front of multi-million-dollar homes squatting on top of sand dunes on Long Beach Island and lots of other Bear Islands up and down. So,
You're saying it's really to bail out wealthy people with taxpayer money?
I'm saying that we do bail out wealthy people with taxpayer money. You know, personally, I have very mixed views about all of this and how far we should go to save people at the coast, to save them from their own mistakes, right? I mean, everybody knows nowadays what's coming.
Right.
If you don't believe in climate change, then that's totally on you. If you don't think the seas are rising, that's on you.
That's all measurable.
Oh, it's all been measured. And as recently as last week, we had a new report from the UN, and it reaffirmed everything we know and pointed out, among other things, that a 1 in 100-year flood is in 30 years going to be an annual event in the United States. So the risks are known. And then it becomes a question of, in my mind, and what I write about, is how do you apportion that risk? How much of it should be private? How much of it should be public? And I think that's a critical question that the state has never addressed.
We were talking about this, Andrew, before going on the air about this new UN report. How much, by the end of this century, by 2100, what is the UN predicting in terms of sea level rise?
Well, that report, I think it's an upwards of, that's actually a conservative report, around 4 feet. And, you know,
this is globally, obviously.
Globally, yeah. And we can talk about relative sea level rise, and that gets tricky. But I just, you know, I should mention that there's so many variables. I mean, this summer in the Arctic was the hottest summer ever. They're looking at huge ice sheet melt. So if something like that were to happen, sea level rise would break this modest estimate of 4 feet.
Let me ask you, Gilbert, about insurance. And in certain ways, that's why people go into some of these more risky properties along the coast.
Right.
And I've always wondered if the insurance industry just said, wiped their hands and said, look, if you're going to build a $4 million house on Long Beach Island, that's on you, but we are not going to insure your house.
Well,
would that change anything?
The private insurance industry, in fact, did exactly that back in the 30s. After the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, they basically walked away from private flood insurance. And then over time, and I won't give all the details, but over time, we convinced the federal government to get into the business of providing flood insurance. And most people think, well, it was for the Mississippi and for the Midwest and all that. But the reality is it's mostly a coastal program. And 75% of the losses in that program or claims in that program are at the coast, not inland. So it's really a subsidy for, in many cases, wealthy homeowners. I mean, by definition, if you live at the coast these days, unless you inherited a house, you have to be wealthy to buy one. And it helps to keep them in place. The question of whether it should still exist is a really interesting one. And Craig Fugate, who ran FEMA during the Obama administration and including the flood insurance program, told me that, you know, maybe we should set a date. January 1, 2021, and say to Americans, we are no longer, the federal government, going to write flood insurance if you build a house in the floodplain. One other quick fact.
Sure.
When I did this book, I asked the question, well, how many of the 5 million homes insured by the federal government are second homes, beach houses? And FEMA said they couldn't tell me. I did some back-of-the-envelope math and came up with a figure of 1.3 million. Turns out the GAO once estimated 1.7 million. So basically, one of every three or one of every four homes that's insured for flood is a beach house or a second home. Why is the federal government in the business of insuring beach houses?
Interesting. Let me read a comment from Dave, and this is for you, Andrew. He said, I lived on Money Island, and the DEP threatened me with fines if I did not sell my land to the state. Did you hear stories like that?
Yeah, there's tons of stories like that. It was a threat of fines for various reasons, health violation codes. And I'll just touch on one thing that really put them in a tough situation in Money Island. You know, on the Jersey Shore, because of all of this investment in infrastructure there, you know, most of those places have city water. So on the Bay Shore and Money Island in particular, everyone's still on the individual septics. And what happens when if you don't shore up the land, natural erosion occurs, sea levels are rising, properties on Money Island literally do not have enough dirt left to put a septic system in.
Wow.
So what do you do when the state isn't helping you out getting the permits for that bulkhead that you need to shore up your property, and yet you're still getting notices of violation for a septic tank or something like that you actually cannot fix? So it was everyone was tied in a bind between sort of county violations and state violations.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Andrew Lewis, author of The Drowning of Money Island. He's a contributing writer to Outside Magazine and the New York Times Magazine. Gilbert Gall is with us as well, 2 times Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and his new book is called The Geography of Risk. We're focusing largely on New Jersey, although coastal communities across and around the country are being affected by storms and sea level rise and raising a whole host of questions about getting insurance, who pays, who doesn't, who wins, who loses. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just a recap here. Coastal communities are facing rising seas and stronger storms caused by climate change. And as it turns out, New Jersey is seeing some of the fastest sea level increases in the country. This hour, we're looking at the cost of building up and defending shore towns, who is fitting the bill, and whether or not we are fighting a losing battle. Again, our guests are Gilbert Gall, author of The Geography of Risk, and Andrew Lewis, The Drowning of Money Island. Let me get Suzanne from Manahawkin. She's been waiting very patiently. Suzanne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much.
I
am calling to say that I represent Long Beach Island, Beach Haven, particularly of the 1960s. My dad was born there. His dad was from that area. My parents bought a property for $500 in 1949. They couldn't afford the bigger lot next to them for $1,000. Mm. It was a working class town, as you say. My dad was a local mailman. My mom was the secretary of the little grade school. And we were townies. You know, they had summer folks, but they rented the Cape Cod. And I went away to college. I live in Annapolis, Maryland, another tourist area.
Yeah.
And I see similarities. I'm going to call it gentrification in some ways. You know, the older lady dies and leaves her little house and someone buys it and makes it into a McMansion of sorts.
Well,
and when I go to the island, I'm here now visiting because my mom is in the hospital. She's 90. When I go over to the island, it's not the island that I grew up on. I go down the street I grew up on, and it's the twilight zone.
Well, you know, Suzanne, I appreciate your call, and I know you have many stories to tell us. And Gilbert Gall has lived some of this with you as well. You worked there in the summer as a kid.
I did. I lived there in the 60s and then early 70s. I was a lifeguard on Iroquois Avenue in Beach Haven. So I have, and I keep going back to the island. I still surf there. And so I've watched it since 62. I've watched all the changes that Suzanne mentioned. And those changes are clearly accelerating after Sandy. And Beach Haven's a great example. Yeah. It's emptying out of year-round residents, as are many other barrier islands, simply because these places are becoming investment communities and the year-round populations are disappearing.
Suzanne, I appreciate that call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Gilbert, let me go back to you and talk about, you added up, I guess, all the cost of communities along coastal America, and what's the number you came up with? In terms of value.
Right. I use a conservative value as of 2016 or 15, I forget which year, of $3 trillion for the Atlantic and Gulf Coast. And that just includes all of the oceanfront communities and barrier islands. There are 3,000 barrier islands in America. Right. And then the communities along the bays and sounds immediately behind those barrier islands.
So if, you know, there was some devastating storm that just wiped them out, that would be $3 trillion worth of...
Well, I mean, we're not going to have a storm that large, even with climate change. However, what's happening, what's fascinating is if you look at the damage from hurricanes, it's really these large epical storms that cause the preponderance of damage. So there are 20 hurricanes since 2000 that have caused $724 billion worth of damage, right? That's an extraordinary run-up in damage during that time period. Of those, Katrina, Sandy, Harvey, and a couple of others are responsible for the bulk of that damage. So it's really these big events combined with climate change that is causing all this damage.
And the fact that so many millions of people have moved to the coast compared to when we were youngsters.
Or have invested at the coast is the way I would say it. Because, in so many cases, they're not really living there.
Right. They're renting or who knows.
They're using a property for you know, a few weeks or a few months out of a year.
You talk to a lot of people, Andrew, for your book, and including a couple named Mike and Kate. Tell us about Mike and Kate.
Yeah, Mike and Kate are great. They sort of embody this idea of resiliency on the Bay Shore. They've lived their whole lives in Bay Point, raised their kids there. Their home was completely destroyed by Sandy. And when Blue Acres came around, Mike and Kate made the decision that they were going to stay. And, you know, at that time, there were about 70 homes in Bay Point. And the local government got behind Blue Acres in their municipality, which is Lawrence Township. And that sort of helped bring all of Mike and Kate's neighbors together to make this decision to sell at the Blue Acres. Mike and Kate, they didn't want to leave.
Yeah. So it's their home, right?
It's their home. It, you know, they used to own the marina there. They hosted all of the summer fishing tournaments, and they really were, even when it was still a community, they were the heart of that community. And it was hard for them to see all of their neighbors leave, but even harder was to move away from the water.
So they're there now?
They're there now.
And what are they living in?
So I had mentioned earlier that a couple characters in the book moved into a trailer. That was Mike and Kate Nelson. Mm-hmm. So they spent years in that trailer biding their time, building a small bungalow on that same property where the trailer was parked. It's on a creek. It's on the creek side of Bay Point rather than the bay. Hmm. They'll never move back to the bayfront again because of the sort of the terror that Sandy put them through. But they've persevered, and now they have this nice little bungalow on the creek. And
are they happy?
They are happy. They get to crab. They love crabbing, and that's something they do together in the summers, and they still get to do that, and they can walk right out the back door, get in the boat, and go do that.
A question from Manny. Can your guest speak to the changes in Delaware shore towns like Rehoboth and Dewey Beach? And I don't think, Gilbert, you looked at them specifically, but can we kind of extrapolate from our conversation?
Sure. The same trends are occurring in those kinds of beach towns that are occurring up and down the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast. So it really echoes many of the same themes we're discussing.
An email from George. Why should society pay for someone's vacation property because they choose to live in a flood-prone area? I mean, that's the question kind of hanging over this conversation.
It is. That and what's the future going to look like, right? I discuss all of that in my book, and it is the critical question because we've really, I'm going to use this in air quotes, have planned our way into this disaster that's looming ahead. And it's really a man-made disaster. It's not a natural disaster. I understand how we react immediately after storms and empathy, et cetera. But what's so frustrating is that it's rare for anyone to step back and pause and say, we need to hit the pause button here and think about how we live by the water, how we're going to live by the water in an age of climate change, rising water, bigger, more powerful storms. And you know what? There are nonprofit groups and academics who do this research, and they do terrific work. But at the immediate coast, we're only really beginning to wake up to these questions. And in some cases, it just simply is going to be too late to do anything meaningful.
Well, I'm thinking about some of those property owners you hear about who don't want dunes in front of their very expensive house because it's going to take their view away.
Yep.
But on the other hand, dunes do something, right?
They buy you time.
They buy you time. But you're saying, looking at Long Beach Island, you're saying inevitably, maybe by the end of this century, that will be...
By the end of the century, it'll probably be all underwater. By 2050, if you believe some of the studies that are being done, twice a day, large portions of the island will be covered by water, and they'll be inaccessible except by boat.
Wow.
It already floods very, very badly.
And how about southern New Jersey? And I remember driving through parts of southern New Jersey after some rain, and I noticed there was just sort of a little sort of skiff of water all over the roads. I mean, not flooding, but just it was just there.
Yeah, I mean, I should say I live in Ocean City, which is a southern Jersey Shore town. And just yesterday, the high tide was quite similar to the high tide that we had the night of Hurricane Sandy.
Really?
About 5.5 feet. And it was a beautiful day yesterday, and portions of the island were under several inches of water in intersections and stuff like that. And so that's exactly what's happening in Ocean City is happening in Money Island and Bay Point. You know, yesterday, I'm sure the water was up over the road.
It's happening everywhere.
You look at Miami, right?
Well, yeah, but I also just came back from Charleston last week in North Carolina at the coast where I was giving talks. And Charleston is a great example of a place that's drowning. They get water all the time on the streets. They've put in pumps to pump out water from fairly ordinary storms, but the place keeps flooding.
I mean, can we use infrastructure to somehow build bigger dunes or those things that go out into the ocean?
Sure, and it will buy you time. It's not going to solve the problem. And then the critical question becomes, who's going to pay for that? Are we going to ask the people who benefit most from those ocean views to pay for it? Are we going to ask federal taxpayers, some guy in Colorado, to pay for it? Who's going to pay for it? I mean, that's a discussion that's not being held.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that? And I'll read some more comments.
I just wanted to mention that, that in March of this year, the Army Corps of Engineers released this massive study, which was began from Sandy funding. And it's basically proposals on how to shore up the Jersey Shore. And there's just these massive infrastructure projects, full, moving gates like they have in the Netherlands. And
stilts. I mean, I guess putting things on stilts, right?
Proposals to raise up entire islands. So, for example, Ocean City, where I live, they've put a number to how much it would cost to raise the entire island. So, and this is the Army Corps of Engineers, a federal agency, engaging in a study that's essentially about climate change and sea level rise. And they're looking at these massive problems that are in our near future.
How would you put Ocean City on stilts? I'm way beyond my pay grade.
It's already on stilts. The homes are on stilts. And again, that buys time, but that's all it does.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of my favorite places to visit is Dauphin Island, Alabama, which is a barrier island with zero elevation. And all the vacation homes are almost literally sitting in the Gulf of Mexico. It's been hit by 12 major hurricanes over the last decade or two. Keep rebuilding in the same place. I mean, the houses were on stilts 15 feet in the air prior to Katrina in 2005. I went down there a week after Katrina. All the houses were wiped out. They were gone off of the stilts. All you saw were empty stilts. The reason is Katrina pushed 19 feet of water.
Let me read some more comments. Margaret says, there are thousands of people who live here year-round, even though we have been overwhelmed with large investments in vacation homes. Please don't forget those who make their home here. I don't think we have done that, Margaret.
No.
A comment from Russell. There used to be a limit on new construction on LBI, Long Beach Island, after Sandy, that was lifted. What's going to happen to the island in 10 years? I'm afraid it's going to be gone. 10 years?
You know, my theory is that what's going to change all this is the intersection of climate change in the next couple of decades with property values. We're beginning to see price signals in the market that where you incorporate the effects of climate change into the values of home and real estate begins to flatten out or even go down. And that I've been around the country and I have seen places where it's already happening. That's some very smart analysts, much smarter than me, are saying is our future. So if you have a crash in real estate prices, that will change everything.
Well, and you just nodded your head there, Andrew.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think that's going to be the signal that changes everything is when real estate starts to plateau and then start to go down.
Yep.
But which comes first? Is it people saying, I don't want to buy this property because it's –
well.
I can't afford it, essentially?
One analyst whom I follow jokingly said maybe it's time to start shorting real estate at the coast. And he ran a billion-dollar investment fund. So this guy is while he was perhaps joking a little bit, he really wasn't joking. And he was talking about South Florida. I can see a time in the not-distant future where we begin to see things like that.
Wow. And I'm also thinking of, not the resort towns, but the towns that you have looked at or the town you looked at, Andrew, where there is this way of life. I mean, it sounds things are changing. That way of life is also changing as well. But this is where people have raised families and put down roots.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's inevitable, right? The water's going to come up and people are going to have to move. I think what I always go back to, certainly in the book, is this issue of equity. You know, if this is a problem that we are looking at, if we can just move past this silly idea of is it real, is it not, and stop fighting over that and really get down to the nitty-gritty business of dealing with these issues, we need to look at them in terms of equity, right? Because
fair, right?
Right. I mean, if one of the core ideals of this country is, you know, all men are created equal, you know, if everyone's indivisible, you know, we have a chance here to start dealing with managed retreat with climate change in an equitable way instead of making the inequitable mistakes of the past that we've done so many times over. So, I see it as an opportunity to start to implement policy that actually can move everyone somehow.
Well, time will tell. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate you both coming in and writing your books as well. Andrew Lewis, author of The Drowning of Money Island. He's a contributing writer to Outside Magazine and The New York Times Magazine. He's speaking at the Penn Book Center on Thursday, October 3rd at 6 p.m. Gilbert Gahl is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His book is called The Geography of Risk. He's speaking at Inkwood's Books in Haddonfield, New Jersey, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School on Wednesday. No, yes.
Tonight at Inkwood, and tomorrow at Wharton School.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay. I think we'll put it on our Facebook page.
That's a lot.
So there's no confusion. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you,
Marty.
You're welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.